The House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development will come to order. Welcome all of you for being here today, and I think we'll start, colleagues, with opening a work session on House Bill 2140. Zach, will you tell us about the bill?
House Bill 2140 requires a person at the age of 18 to take an approved driver's education course prior to receiving a provisional driver's license if they reside in Clackamas, Multnomah, or Washington counties.
And we, of course, in work session, will only have invited testimony. We have a person here who would like to speak on this bill. Layla, is it Simon? Would you, if you'll come forward, that would be great. And tell us your name. And yes, right there is perfect.
Good afternoon, committee members. My name is Layla Simon. I'm a senior at Wilson High School.
And I understand that you are participating in Girl Scout activities, and this is part of that program.
Yes.
But tell us about the program. Did you have to do all the stuff my son has to do to become an Eagle Scout? Is that kind of the similar thing?
Well, it's the highest award in Girl Scouts is called the Gold Award. So basically what it is you set up a series of community benefiting activities based on what you're passionate about. So you basically design the award yourself, and then it's approved by that committee. And then they lay out a letter of all the things you need to complete to get your award.
And so how does this fit into that?
Well, for my award, I wanted to benefit my community by advocating for the importance of driver's education. So I laid out in my letter that I would submit legislation trying to make driver's ed mandatory in Oregon. It wasn't required that it necessarily went through, but just that I went through the process. And the second part is to organize a middle school assembly to inform eighth graders about driver's education.
And so you, I don't want to put words in your mouth, so you're here today to talk a little bit about this bill. Is that your thought, or do you want to share your thinking on HB 2140 with the committee?
Yes.
Please do.
All right.
And I'm not sure, I think you did state your name, but state it again. Just make sure I have the pronunciation of your first name correctly.
Layla Simon.
Thank you.
In January, I submitted a similar legislation making driver's ed education mandatory, and it was sponsored by Representative Garrett, who is my state representative. And his staff informed me that Oregon Department of Transportation was submitting a similar bill sponsored by the governor. And so he suggested I contacted Amy Joyce, which I did, because I wanted to be a part of the bill, because I truly think that driver's education is really important. So basically why I think driver's education is important is because car crashes are the leading cause of teen death in America, and I think that if they're required to take driver's education before they get their license, that the overall skill level of drivers on the road would increase, thus decreasing the number of crashes and overall saving lives. And I think that in the manner of budget, that it would pay for itself, because the state would pay less in health expenses and police expenses and ambulances, that sort of thing.
So, well, before I ask you my questions, does the committee have questions for our witness?
Sure.
Representative Smith.
Are your parents here?
My mom is here today.
Is she very proud?
Yeah.
Good, good. I may have other questions. That's the only one that came to mind.
Everybody. Okay.
Yes, Co-Chair Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to start with a comment and just thank you for being a part of the discussion, the process. Not enough people who do that, particularly people of your age. I'm particularly struck by your advocacy on this issue, and it encourages me to ask you a question about another proposal and an opportunity to sort of share something that I've worked a little bit on and been disappointed by. We did frequently in the legislature make changes to various traffic laws and so on, and it struck me a while ago that these changes are of limited value if people don't know about them. So I engaged in some discovery about the possibility of requiring people to take the written test every time they renew their licenses. Thought it could be online, thought it could be open book, but the idea of having to refresh one's memory about how these things work and learn about the new changes might be an idea. What do you think of that idea?
I agree. I think that's a very good idea because I know that a lot of times when I was studying to get my permit, a lot of adults I talked to didn't know a lot of the current versions of the laws, not to point anyone out, but...
Everyone behind you, maybe, and yeah. In front of you. And in front of you.
I think that's a really good idea.
Thank you. Maybe, Mr. Chair, we can help Lila find a platinum award in a new project.
Yes, maybe. Yes, Representative Nathan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to pile on to the congratulations and say I'm sending my greetings from a fellow Girl Scout. Many years ago, I was in Troop 117 in Dallas, Texas, and I got those badges with pride, but it seems like the way badges are developed now, it's an even better and more challenging opportunity, and congratulations to you for what you're doing. Keep
Thank
doing
you.
It.
Further questions?
Yeah.
Yeah, Representative Sensen.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So I already asked a really important question, but say more about why only, and if this is repeat, I apologize, but say more about why only Washington, Clackamas, and Multnomah.
Well, initially, the bill I submitted was to be the entire state. Amy kind of explained to me that right now it's only those kind of metro counties because there aren't enough educators and teachers to do it necessarily in all the bordering counties, and there's a lot of people who might not be able to afford the required fee right away. So maybe it'll spread out, hopefully, but right now I think it's smart just to start with those initial counties.
Follow up.
And say more about what you think. Have you thought about what training should include, what training shouldn't include? Does it need to be by a particular person or set of people? Any guidance on that that we should be keeping in mind, either for passage of the bill or for implementation later?
Well, right now it's just Oregon Department of Transportation approved. Is that correct?
So I think that's right.
So I think I'm sure they have pretty laid out guidelines as to what counts as approved by them and not approved. When I took it, it was, I think, 60 hours or 30 hours, 30-hour class, and then 30 hours of driving instruction. I'm not exactly sure if I know exactly what information should be included.
That's a great answer. I'm all good. Thank you.
Okay.
Further questions? I have one. You must have spoken to your classmates and others about the bill. What did they think? Were they happy that you were doing this or not so much?
Well, not all of my friends have taken driver's education, but I have a lot of friends who are younger, like freshmen and sophomores, and I'm always... Like, I've been talking to some of them about it and trying to convince them to take driver's ed because I really think it's important. And most of my friends who are my age who have taken it are really supportive, and they agree that it helped them become a better driver.
Thank you. No further questions. Well, thank you so very much for being here today, and Ms. Simon, and we appreciate your testimony.
Thanks.
And with that, you can return to... I'm guessing that's your mom back there. I'm just guessing. And thank her for being here also. So with that, I think this bill is ready to be worked. And we will... I would entertain a motion from Vice Chair, since I don't seem to have a co-chair anymore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House Bill 2081... Oops, I'm on the next one. What's the right number?
2140.
House Bill 2140 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a prior...
Nope.
Just
Yeah, that's it. There's no prior reference.
Does the floor with a due pass recommendation?
It's been moved that House Bill 2140 pass the floor with a due pass recommendation. I think for purposes of the audience, we'll have the clerk call roll.
Do you want discussion?
All right. Discussion. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have a question for the Department of Transportation. Could we have the gentleman from the Department of Transportation come to answer a quick question for me?
Sure, please.
I'm sure he can hear me as he walks down here. During your testimony, I asked a question about insurance companies and what happened in other states when it came to the discount that they were offering the kids that had taken driver's ed, and you were going to follow up and find out what happened with that in other states, whether that discount went away when they mandated this. What did you find out?
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Sheehan, Troy Casales, Administrator of the Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. We did ask our neighboring states in relationship to their experience for insurance, and we didn't get any conclusive evidence that there was something that was negative in those states or anything that was necessarily positive. The one thing that was consistent in the response is that since insurance is private, private companies and private enterprise in relationship to how that's done, it's all based on the actuarials. What did they experience in their states? And then they set their rates based on what they're experiencing in the claims, both for injury as well as then property damage. And there was nothing in there that came back to say that they could give us any advice, pro or con, in relationship to the question that you had asked.
The elimination of the discount itself did not happen anywhere because they mandated it?
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Sheehan, none of the states indicated that they lost coverage or lost discounts because of having mandatory driver education.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And just for the record, pass the note. But and actually, from you, it would also be helpful. So one question I might get for a constituent is, well, my kid or I myself don't have a lot of dough. Spending the $200 to $550 to do driver's education could be burdensome. And my response might be, oh, no, you can test out, or might be something else. And the chair gave me a nod and said, yeah, there's ways to get around that. If you could help us with that on the record, that'd be helpful.
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Smith. In statute today, any of the providers for driver education must have some sort of policy of how to deal with low or no income so that they've got a sliding scale. In a couple cases, there are some grants that those entities have achieved, and so they're able to subsidize that way. Currently in the process, the department is allowed to subsidize up to $210 per eligible pupil in order to lower the cost to the student or to the family for driver education. And during the public hearing, I also testified my own personal experience with my son who went through driver education. When we got his first 6 months of insurance bill post taking his driver education course, I almost made, quote-unquote, back through insurance savings what the cost was to me as a parent just in that first 6 months, and he has continued on with some of those insurance discounts now even to the age of 20 because he did take the course. And so I've recouped that initial class cost, which may seem like a lot up front, but the true one of the biggest costs in relationship to a teen driver is that insurance piece, as Representative Sheehan was asking. I know as a parent, it has more than paid back because no crashes, no citations for my son once going through the class.
Thanks very much. I went to the R.P. Joe Smith School of Driving, and it was my dad, and he was rigorous. But anyway, thanks very much, Mr. Chair.
Yes, President.
Now, so, colleagues, I do have some concerns with this bill. First of all, I question what are we doing right now? What are we doing right now that currently that is so bad? I guess the argument is that by mandating driver's ed, commercial driver's ed, that it will reduce crashes. I haven't seen any empirical data or evidence saying that what we're doing right now is causing more crashes. I haven't seen that. And this is an argument against driver's ed. I went to driver's ed. I think it was great, and people have that choice. They can still go through driver's ed if they want. I think what we have right now is currently working is just fine. There's no imminent need to pass this. There's no public outcry to pass this. This gives a lot of discretion, additional discretion to ODOT. And when I say discretion, I say power. here's the costs. ODOT estimates the total cost of this bill at $1.6 million of other funds in the 2011-2013 biennium, and another $4.2 million other funds in the 2013-15 biennium. If driver's ed is so important, why not extend it down to the Salem-Keizer area? Why aren't we doing that? And let me just read you. There's also other consequences that will happen here. Here's a letter of someone that I will not read their name because they're concerned about the repercussions that they might face. But they own a driver's ed course, and they state, I work in the three counties that will be affected by this bill. My business will be cut in half, and 7 of my 15 employees will have to be cut from my roster. That's a constituent. I don't think it's worth the experiment, and so I'll be voting no. I urge your no vote as well.
Further discussion? A couple of remarks. First, I want to thank Simon again for her testimony. It was very much appreciated. And I think I recall from previous discussions and some of the testimony we heard that the department has $10 million in an account to pay that which you just referred to, Representative Lindsay. And thus, the amount that I think you're referring to is already in hand and sitting there, not being spent because we don't have sufficient kids signing up for the program. I won't use my son as an example, but I will say that it's been my observation that folks that take driver's ed seem to know a lot more about driving than those that don't. And I also know that the fact that insurance costs go down is proof enough of the value of the program, because they certainly wouldn't if that wasn't the case. So I'll be supporting the bill, and I'm thinking that if it doesn't work well, it will just been imposed upon those three counties, which happen to be, I think, the most populated ones in Oregon. And if it does work well, then it can be, of course, extended. Is there further discussion? Yes.
If I might just respond to 2 points that you made. Yes, the money's sitting there, but yes, those expenses will be expended, which could be spent on something else, number one. Number two, the insurance is an incentive for people like me to do that through my insurance, and I have every right to do that. And I think that that's a great incentive for people to do it, but I don't think we should mandate it.
Thank you for that point. It's appreciated. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just in response, the money that's sitting in account for this is for driver's ed. Specifically, it won't go anywhere else. So I wanted to put that on the record.
Thank you, Representative Smith.
I apologize, Mr. Chair, and don't mean. Although, where's our wonderful proponent?
Right.
Oh, there she is, right there. Sorry, and let this be no reflection on you. But this is how it happens, and actually, this is the kind of discussion you want, frankly, because too often we barely read the bill and then we just pass it along and hope that somebody else figured it out. And so, it's actually good that we come to grips with it. You should be honored. But I do apologize for taking the time. I'm sensitive to what Representative Lindsay said, and also some assurance. So what I heard was, I think, from the Department of Transportation, that it would only cost $290 to do or less, and that would be paid back by the insurance. But I'm not sure I heard that there was a free option. And I'm not saying there necessarily needs to be a free option. If somebody give me confidence, that would be great. I may also, I won't know until you call the roll, but I also may be a no until we get to the floor. I reserve the right to flip my vote, but I might also be a no on the referral, barring an answer to that question.
Further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Lindsay?
No.
Representative Nathanson?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
No.
Representative Widener?
Excused.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Yes.
Chair Reed?
Aye.
Chair Bann?
Aye.
Yes.
Nathanson didn't come.
No, I'm.
Oh, did you?
You did call Representative Nathanson's.
Yeah,
yeah, she
voted. Yeah.
Thank you. And what was our vote count?
5-2.
Five ayes.
Five ayes.
Four, two, and one.
No, five, two, and one.
Five, two, and one. The bill having received a majority of the votes and passes to the floor, that I'll close the work session, and we need a carrier. Somebody volunteering.
Lindsay.
Yes, Representative, you want to carry
it? I'd be happy to carry it.
And the carrier will be Representative Sheehan. And with that, we will move to the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2081. And Zach, tell us about the bill.
House Bill 2081 authorizes the Environmental Quality Commission to establish requirements to reduce aerodynamic drag and rolling resistance on heavy-duty tractors and trailers. Also authorizes the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt rules limiting idling, offers incentive for early compliance, phases in over a period, 2016 for tractors, 2018 for trailers, allows for some economic hardship exemptions, and that all reflects the bill as introduced.
Thank you, and we have a number of people signed up on this bill. Let's start with Bob Russell and Dan Emerson. Oh, sure. Let's start with the director. Sorry, director. Please come up. For some reason, it looked like link here. We're going to have to work on your spelling.
The top of the D is kind of vacant.
Director, please.
Yes, Co-Chair Bantz, Co-Chair Reed for the record, Dick Peterson, Director of Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality. And with me today is Andy Ginsberg, our Air Quality Administrator. He's not going to provide testimony, but if you have questions about the work we did on this and the bill itself, he's here to answer some of those. So I'm here to talk to you about House Bill 2081, and it's a bill that is intended to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. In the 2009 legislative session, the legislature enacted House Bill 2186 to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector, since transportation is a significant contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. Specific to commercial trucking, the bill directed DEQ to do three things. First, to conduct a study of potential requirements for retrofitting medium and heavy-duty trucks in order to reduce aerodynamic drag and greenhouse gas emissions from those trucks. That was the first thing. The second thing was to study potential restrictions on engine idling in commercial vehicles. And finally, the bill directed DEQ to consult with relevant stakeholders to develop a report based on the truck efficiency study and make recommendations for the legislature. In response, DEQ did assemble a 26-member diverse stakeholder group that met four times to provide input on potential requirements. DEQ submitted the results of the truck efficiency study to the Interim Natural Resource Committees in September of 2010, and the recommendations are incorporated into House Bill 2081. In particular, the bill would establish requirements to improve fuel efficiency and thereby reduce greenhouse gas emissions from heavy-duty trucks and box-type trailers. Examples of this include adding fairings to reduce aerodynamic drag and low-rolling resistant tires. To provide flexibility, the bill also would delay compliance with those provisions until 2016 or later. It would apply only to trucks that would get a quick payback, meaning that the savings in fuel would pay back quickly in terms of the equipment installed. And it would also defer requirements if fleet owners are unable to obtain financing for those retrofits. Despite these features, DEQ understands that there may not be support for truck efficiency requirements at this time, given the current economic situation. The bill would also limit unnecessary idling by commercial motor vehicles. DEQ does understand that there may be more support for legislation to reduce idling. Eliminating unnecessary idling will reduce greenhouse gas emissions, toxic air pollutants, and nuisances. So with that concludes my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for the director?
Yes, Chair Reed.
Thank you, Chair. Could you tell us some more about how you might expect the work to go forward on aerodynamics? I appreciated your comments about the current economic situation being a factor as to how that hasn't come together as some might hope, but do you have expectations that that work will continue and that there might be a future legislature who hears you or your successor talk about an agreement?
Co-Chair Vance, Co-Chair Reed, I'll take a shot at it and then perhaps Mr. Ginsburg can add to it. But what I would say is that when it comes to technology is advancing, that we'll continue as a state to look at this, take advantage of what other states are doing and looking at that kind of equipment on trucks and vehicles. And possibly, if and when the economy turns around, it'll be more of an opportunity for the trucking industry to participate in this. I don't believe long term the conversation is dead on this issue, but I think from what I hear in terms of lack of support, the timing is not right.
Okay, I like the second option, the when as opposed to if, on the economy.
Okay.
Further questions? Yes, Rev. Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wouldn't just the fuel efficiency of idling for a long period of time cause somebody to not idle more than 5 minutes? I mean, is this really a problem?
Co-Chair Vance, Representative Sheehan, perhaps Bob Russell from the trucking industry, when he comes up, can address that question. But I do believe I'm not sure about the benefit of long-term idling, other than the need to enhance air conditioning and use in the cab of the kind of equipment that trucks like to use. And I can't speak to the shutting on and shutting off of diesel engines. But one of the ideas, certainly long-term, is that trucks in some situations would have an opportunity either to retrofit cabs or plug into electric power to feed those power supplies.
So someone needs air conditioning in their truck, and we're going to deny them the ability to fuel that? I mean, is that what you're saying?
Co-Chair Vance, Representative Sheehan, I believe there are provisions that would allow, trucks to not lose their air conditioning, for sure, lose the comfort of their vehicle, you know, of their vehicle.
I'm really concerned about comfort. I'm concerned about safety.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Perhaps, Mr. Ginsburg, you can...
Yes. Co-Chairs, Representative Sheehan, the bill has an exemption for time periods where the temperature is cold or where the temperature is hot, so that heating and air conditioning could be used. Although that exemption phases out after a period of time, and the idea it would be replaced by other alternatives such as onboard generators called auxiliary power units that could power the air conditioning systems using a lot less fuel or plug-in options.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
The device, you wonder if it's, after you tie in all of the exemptions and all the exceptions and all of the what-ifs, you wonder if it's worth all the effort. And so, I mean, it kind of reminds me of some other things we've done, which after you back out all the exceptions, there's not enough left there to make it worth anybody's while to go around and try to regulate.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it that a truck driver looking at this wouldn't they find some sort of an exception here somewhere for just about anything they've done? Or is there some huge scope of practice you're trying to get at that wouldn't somehow fall into one of these exceptions?
Co-Chair Bentz, maybe Andy, you can take a shot at that, please.
Yeah. Co-Chairs Bentz, the two primary focuses on the idling portion of the bill have to do with overnight idling and sleeper cabs, and we just talked about that in terms of, you know, when the temperature may drop overnight and the ability to use heating systems, with the idea of having a transition period so that we could move to more fuel-efficient ways of keeping the cab comfortable for overnight idling. And the second area has to do with loading and unloading. So the bill limits the amount of idling that would occur during loading and unloading. We have in some situations where trucks may be queued in a long line or waiting for a loading facility to open. We could have loading for extended periods of time, perhaps near residential areas. So the bill restricts that as well. So those are the two, I would say, primary focuses.
And the cost of enforcement, how is this actually going to be enforced? and who's going to pay for that, and what kind of a fiscal would go along with this if it passed?
Coach Bence, we had envisioned that the bill would be implemented primarily through education. There's a provision requiring distribution centers to install signs indicating the limitations on idling during loading and unloading. And in addition, we would work with the Trucking Association and others to get the word out to truckers that about overnight idling. And we didn't put a fiscal on the bill for that purpose, and also the delay in implementation. So this would go into effect after a period of time, allowing us plenty of time to get outreach and education. Most likely, we would that the type of implementation we would do would be to identify perhaps during the initial implementation, maybe go to some truck stops and work with them and that kind of thing. So we hadn't envisioned a heavy-handed type of enforcement.
Andy, I forgot to ask you to identify yourself.
I'm sorry, Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator at DEQ.
Have any other states done this?
Yes. Our bill is actually based on a model rule that was put together by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency working with the National Trucking Association. And the idea is that we're seeing somewhat of a proliferation of different idling restrictions across the country, and a benefit of having something that's more uniform, so truckers who are traveling across the country can expect to see a similar kind of requirements from state to state. And that was the purpose of the EPA National Trucking Association model rule. EPA doesn't have the ability to implement it nationally, so they've recommended to states that we implement it. There's a similar provision in California, and other states in the area are looking at it as well. And I don't have the list with me, but I'd be happy to get that for you.
By the similar provision, you mean California has adopted this?
Yes.
The savings would be of interest. Can you give us an amount of diesel that a, quote, normal Kenworth burns as it sits there idling?
Co-Chair Bence, we have that information. I don't have it with me, and I could get that for you as well. It's fairly significant when you think about the amount of fuel that's consumed with overnight idling, and I can get you those numbers.
They would be helpful. We're not prepared to move the bill today, so we have until early next week. The amount of savings that you think would be achieved across the board would be welcome, and also the amount that the single truck would be otherwise burning would be welcome. I want to go back to this enforcement piece again because it's of interest to me. Am I hearing that if this bill passed, the department wouldn't add any further FTE? Is that what I'm hearing?
With regard to the idling portion, we had envisioned it being an educational implementation.
So, okay, I'm not following that. I don't know how that happens. Does the bill passes? Does it just we just assume it? The word gets out somehow, or is there does somebody in the department do something?
Well, Co-Chair Bence, I'll take a step. We would provide very limited resource as far as educational material through the Trucking Association, get the word out, and so it would be very electronic and reaching out in a very, very minor way.
And if I could add, the key factor would be having signs posted at loading and unloading facilities so people would be aware of the requirements.
But that signage exercise would require some effort, some printing costs. There's some costs there. Have those numbers been run?
We do have a fiscal on the bill, and the department wasn't planning on printing the signs and distributing them. There would be some cost for us in initial rulemaking to lay out the requirements that we'd have the resources in-house to handle that. And then otherwise, in terms of outreach, that would just be absorbed within existing resources.
I guess I'm trying to get at who actually has to put up the signs. Is that something the state does, or does the state tell somebody else to do it?
In the bill, it requires the distribution facilities to install the signs.
And do we know what that's going to cost them?
I don't have that information, but we could try and make an estimate of that.
we would sure need to know what sort of cost this bill would impose upon, I'm assuming you're talking truck stops, pilot, loves, so forth and so on. Is that what you're thinking? And then I think you've addressed this, but it's not clear enough for me to understand it. The truck that pulls into the parking area and the driver lets the motor idle all night, that's the type of practice you're trying to stop. Is that what I'm hearing? Or because there's a lot of exceptions here about temperature and other things that would require the truck to keep on idling. So I'm just wondering which trucks, if technology is going to work its way out of this just by virtue of the cost of fuel, because it's so expensive to keep doing it, and if this bill anticipates something that's going to change over time in any event.
Co-Chair Benz, the bill has a deferral for 3 years for overnight idling when the temperature falls outside of the acceptable range. And after that time, it doesn't specify or require specifically what needs to be done, but the implication is that drivers would need alternatives, and the primary alternatives are either truck stop electrification, which we've put some effort into already through Oregon Solutions and other approaches, but needs more development, and also these auxiliary power units, which are like small generators on the truck that can power the electrical systems. And so the idea would be during that three-year time period, there would be a transition, and then the temperature deferral would end, and then overnight idling would have to stop.
If California is doing this, then are you starting to see trucks with these devices already installed because California is not allowing this? Or am I correct in understanding that California's prohibition on overnight idling is part of their law? Am I understanding that they've done this already? We probably need a summary of what California has done so we can see what's going to happen as a matter of course anyway by virtue of California's activities. So maybe you could provide that also if you don't mind.
I can do that. And Bob Russell probably can also partially answer that question.
Okay. Yes, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The phrase truck stop electrification was raised. And so for me, that raises the issue of rest stop electrification. On my trip from home to the Capitol, it used to be I'd see it more often. Maybe I'm just coming at an earlier hour these days, but sometimes there would be a row of many trucks stopped. I don't know whether you call it overnight. Sometimes it lasts well into the day. It depends whenever the rest period, mandated rest period needed to occur. But there were lots of trucks stopped at a rest stop, not actually a truck stop. So is there some way to allow for, or do you anticipate providing services now at other locations in addition to commercial truck stops?
Co-Chairs, Representative Nathanson, we've discussed this some with ODOT in the past. It might be best to ask them that question, but I think for a number of reasons, they don't favor encouraging overnight idling at rest stops. So the focus really has been on electrification at truck stops. But as I said, there are other alternatives like auxiliary power units so that if a trucker was not within easy reach of a truck stop, they would be able to still operate their air conditioning systems without having to go to a truck stop. There's been, as I mentioned, there's been some effort to electrify truck stops already. It's in early stages, and we have somewhat of a chicken and egg problem right now where until the demand is there, we won't see enough truck stops really being able to make a business case for installing the equipment. And so the idea of having a transition period where people can plan for it and know that there's going to be a time period when overnight idling won't be allowed, they can plan to provide those services.
Any questions? I understand that there's been some proposed amendments to the bill, but those amendments are not yours. Is my understanding correct, or do you have an amendment?
Co-Chair Benz, they are not our amendments.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Further questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
You're welcome. We'll provide the information that you're requesting.
You.
Yeah, thank you.
So we'll try this again. Bob Russell and I can't see, I think it's Don Emerson. You need a bill on calligraphy.
I certainly do. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell, Vice President of Government Affairs for the Oregon Trucking Associations, and with me today is Don Emerson. He's president of FMI Truck Services. His company sells most of what we call the medium-duty trucks in the state. I'd like to begin the direct testimony and then turn it to Don to talk about the little trucks. And then I'd like to conclude as we finish our presentation. And I'm hopeful that we can answer a lot of the questions that you've raised so far. The Oregon Trucking Associations does not support House Bill 2081 as it was originally printed. As Director Peterson so eloquently explained it to you, there's two parts to it. There's what we call the truck efficiency pieces, and I think the director acknowledged that this is a very difficult economic climate to require us to purchase the truck efficiency measures. The second part had to do with truck idling. While we think that we need a truck idling regulation, we are concerned about the DEQ proposal from a couple of points of view. It represents a significant uncertainty to us because basically what you are doing, if you pass 2081, is conferring rulemaking authority on DEQ. The regulations themselves would be developed through the administrative rulemaking process, and at this point we would not know exactly what those were. And sort of the second point is that we feel that the proposed regulations are overly broad, and you were starting to get at some of that in the previous discussion. The truck idling regulations would not only cover trucks and trucking companies, but it would also affect our customers, truck stops, truck parking facilities in a variety of ways. And from our perspective, that is much broader than we can support at this time. So what we have done is we have provided an alternative to you. That is the Dash 1 amendments, and I'd like to go through those with you briefly. First, I'd like to tell you that there are 30 states or local jurisdictions within those states that have truck idling regulations. Attached to my testimony, you will find a summary of each one of those regulations along with a link to the full regulations for each one of those that you can look at. The American Trucking Associations does support states adopting truck idling regulations because, as Director Peterson mentioned, the Environmental Protection Agency does not have the authority to develop a uniform truck idling regulation for the country, which is always our preference. Since we operate coast to coast, we would prefer something that applies coast to coast rather than sort of the patchwork quilt. We do believe, however, that a truck idling regulation is appropriate. It will reduce fuel consumption and thereby reduce greenhouse gases and other emissions from trucks. When you look at the amendment, Section 1 puts the amendments in the Motor Vehicle Code, which from our perspective is important because it does a couple of other nifty things, including providing definitions for all the terms that we're using here. Section 2 provides the statement of purpose. Section 3 includes the definitions that govern the regulation, and if they are not defined in the amendment, they are defined in the Motor Vehicle Code. Section 4 sets out the basic standard of 5 minutes of idling per 60 minutes, and provides that a violation of the regulation is enforceable through a uniform traffic citation issued to the truck operator or the trucking company or both. And this is a really key feature of the proposal that we are advancing, is that any law enforcement official would be able to write a ticket if they found a violation of the truck idling regulations. So we are ensured that it will be uniformly enforced throughout the state, And, of course, this dramatically reduces or virtually eliminates the cost of implementation from an enforcement perspective. Section 5 provides a number of exemptions. And Section 6 preempts local governments from adopting their own regulation, just as we would prefer a national regulation so that we have uniformity throughout the country. Barring that, we would like a statewide regulation instead of 256 cities and 36 counties each adopting their own separate idling regulation. One of the reasons that these kinds of regulations are so difficult is because the trucking industry itself is not monolithic. We are extremely diverse because we serve the entire economy. Currently, we're transporting about 75% of the tons of freight that move in this state. So each sector of the trucking industry is unique, as is the sector of the economy that it serves. So when you go to write a regulation covering the trucking industry, it becomes very difficult, and that's one of the reasons that you find a number of exemptions in our proposal. Some of the examples are, you've got cement mixers that are going down the road and you see the barrel of the mixer turning. When they're parked, it continues to turn, and that's run by the truck engine. If you didn't have that barrel turning, then the cement would harden up and you wouldn't be able to pour the cement. So there are a number of trucks that use their main truck engine to drive some other mechanical feature on the truck. Another typical example is a refrigeration unit that refrigerates the cargo area of the truck if someone's transporting perishable commodities and those kinds of things. This also means that there's not a single right answer when it comes to an idling regulation. And as you have the time and are able to look through the various regulations that have been adopted by states and municipalities, you will see that there are virtually every variation on the theme. Some of the key things that I'd like to emphasize in the proposal that we are advancing. Again, it is enforceable with a uniform traffic citation, so it can be enforced across the state, and we're guaranteed that there will be uniform enforcement. We've already talked a little bit about the driver sleeping in the cab. You are aware that under federal hours of service regulations, truck drivers are required to take 10 hours off duty in a 24-hour period. And this is so that they can get their necessary rest and so that when they are driving, they're well-rested and they can drive safely. There are some truck drivers, not by any means not all, that live in their truck. And the only place they have to sleep is in that truck. So the question becomes, what's reasonable so that these folks can get their necessary rest? As you look at the other states' regulations, you will notice that many of them have just said they're exempt. You can when you need to get your rest, you can idle. There is no restriction whatsoever. In our proposal, we have not done that. We patterned it after DEQ's proposal, and we said if the temperature is lower than 50 degrees or greater than 75, then the truck can idle so the driver can get their appropriate rest. DEQ had also proposed 75. Their lower limit was 35, and that seemed like that was awfully low to us. I know I keep my thermostat at home and probably could do a little better, but I keep it at 65 at night and 72 during the day. And that's where I'm comfortable and comfortable sleeping. It seemed like having a lower temperature of 35 degrees was not conducive to the driver getting adequate rest. We've talked a little bit about the preemption provision, and you're going to hear a little bit more about that from the League of Oregon Cities today. They do like, however, the fact that they can issue a citation. Many times, truck idling is a local nuisance issue. A truck, unfortunately, will park in a residential area and idle their truck. And this gives the local law enforcement the ability to enforce the idling regulations, which we think is a good thing. There's also some discussion around the preemption piece. You may recall, those of you that were here in 2009 when we passed House Bill 2001, we had an MPO provision where the MPOs around the state were going to develop a planning process to reduce greenhouse gases and vehicle miles of travel. You may also recall that that provision was limited to vehicles 10,000 pounds and less. And our proposal is limited to vehicles 10,000 pounds and one and greater. So they're not compatible with one another. They are synonymous. We talked a little bit about California's regulation. One of the features of the California regulation is they have no idling regulation whatsoever for vehicles with an engine that was manufactured in 2007 or later. The 2007 truck engines have particulate traps on them and NOx reduction technology. And from California's perspective, they were looking at those types of emissions, and they didn't feel that it was necessary to regulate the idling of trucks as long as they had that technology. Of course, anything from 2007 on does. We did not put that provision in our proposal, primarily because we think that carbon is also an issue, and if we have the idling restrictions on the newer trucks, that also helps to address carbon emissions. There's essentially three ways that you can deal with truck idling, and Representative Bentz, I think, rightly identified one of the most important, if not the most important, and that is the cost of fuel. Fuel is about $4 a gallon today for us. That is very, very expensive. Fuel is almost eclipsing our number one cost in the truck industry, and number one cost would be labor. When it gets a little bit over $4 a gallon, then fuel becomes our single largest cost. So managing fuel and reducing unnecessary idling is a goal of most trucking companies. Most of OTA's members already have idle reduction programs in place. They have the ability to download from the engine's computer, and it will tell them how much time the truck is running at highway speeds, how much it's running at local street speeds, how much is idling with the truck in traffic, and how much is stationary idling. And many of our companies have reward programs, all kinds of things in place to reduce that idling because it's very expensive. For a big truck, will burn about a gallon to a gallon and a half an hour when it's idling. So you can see that for a 10-hour period, that's a fairly significant expenditure. The second thing that we can do is we can provide incentives to reduce the need to idling. Oregon's Betsy program currently provides incentives, 35% tax credits, for the truck efficiency measures that Representative Reed inquired about earlier, but it also provides incentives for the idle reduction technologies. And the principal idle reduction technology is an auxiliary power unit, which comes in a variety of forms. Some of them are very small diesel engines that power the batteries, and then that powers the air conditioner and the heater, but it burns much less fuel. Those run about $7,000 to $10,000, and those go on the truck, and so wherever the truck is, they can switch from that main engine, which is burning a lot of fuel, to a much smaller engine. Some of the more current APUs actually run on battery power alone. When the main engine is driving the truck down the road, the batteries are charged. When the driver's sleeping, the batteries actually cool and heat the truck. So there's no emissions at all. But again, those are very expensive. When they are cost effective with the help of the Betsy program, we do put those on our trucks. The third piece is a truck idling regulation, and we believe that it is appropriate to have a truck idling regulation. We do support the Dash 1 amendments and would ask that you do. There are folks in our industry that still believe that you shouldn't turn off a diesel engine, that you should keep them idling all the time. Modern diesel engines simply do not require that. Years and years ago, some of the engines were difficult to restart, but that hasn't been true for a very long time. We think that an idling regulation is part of the three-part program in order to reduce truck idling. There is another amendment that we have talked about with DEQ, besides the Dash 1s that I believe will become the Dash 2s, that would make it very clear that this idling regulation could be enforced on places accessible to the public, truck stops, truck parking facilities, and those kinds of things. And we would support that amendment. So with that, I would like to turn it over to Don and let him talk about the light trucks, and then we'll be happy to answer any of your questions.
Please. Co-Chairman, thanks for having me and allowing me. This is something that's fairly new for me, but I'm not quite as elegant as Bob. My name is Don Emerson. I own FMI Truck Sales and Service, and we sell medium-duty trucks. I don't do anything with the over-road trucks. I served on the DEQ committee and have been involved with the OTA for a number of years. One of the things that happened to us recently in 2008, one of our manufacturers came out with a product that we'd never seen before called a health report. And for medium-duty trucks, it was the first time that somebody actually gave us a report that said how many gallons of fuel you were burning and what kind of application. I'm an advocate for medium duty. You know, the Class 8 trucks, I understand they burn up, you know, a gallon an hour. Our little trucks burn about 4/10 of a gallon per hour. The difference is our trucks are in town all day, every day. That's all they do. They don't go down the highway. They're not coming from here to California. All the fuel they burn is in usually in a city. And I have some examples that I brought, but I went through that. We have customers who, with all good logic, shouldn't leave their trucks idle when they're making their deliveries with their little trucks. I have an example here where we have a customer who has 3,000 hours of delivery time of total time on his truck, and 1,000 of that is idling in town. They're totally separate issues, in my opinion. There's a difference between the problems and issues with over-the-road trucks. Our guys don't sleep in their trucks. Those are delivery trucks that go out every day. And like Bob pointed out, we do have some of them that have auxiliary power equipment that they have to run, so the engine does have to run for those reasons. But there is a significant amount of fuel that is burned every day while trucks around the city are sitting idling while they're unloading for no good apparent reason. And realistically, in looking at these, with the ability to get the reports for the last 3 years, a good operator uses about 1% or less of the fuel that they have, that they burned idling. We see people with 8, 10, 12, 15% of the fuel idling. That's hundreds of gallons out of, you know, of wasted fuel and emissions. So when Bob and I talked about this and we talked with DEQ, I really felt strong that the issue with the medium-duty trucks, because they're in town every day, all day, is as important, if not more important, in my opinion, than the big trucks. So Bob asked me to come and talk about that a little bit. Thank you. Questions for this panel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've heard almost exclusively about idling, but I was intrigued by what we have called a preliminary staff measure summary, which indicates that the bill authorizes the Environmental Quality Commission to, quote, establish requirements to reduce aerodynamic drag and rolling resistance on heavy-duty tractors and trailers. What can you tell me about that aspect of the bill, the aerodynamic drag?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, That's what we refer to as truck efficiency measures. And you see them going, when you go down the road, you will see the skirts underneath the trailers. You will also see the dams on the top of the trucks, although most of them have them these days. Those have been around for a long time. The trailer skirts have not been around for nearly as long. The low-rolling resistance tires, they range from single-wide tires, and what we do is you've got two tires on each side of an axle. There are new tires that are much wider, and you just put one on each side of that axle, and the rolling resistance is much less. The issue with those things is that they can be very, very expensive. And when you think about an 18-wheeler and replacing all of the tires with low-rolling resistance tires and wheels, and then adding the aerodynamic devices, that can add up to a very healthy chunk of change. We've currently got about 283,000 trucks. And these are just trucks over 26,000 that are operating in Oregon. And if you figure on average, it would cost at least $15,000 per truck. It's a bunch of money in this economy. So, again, the Betsy tax credit program does offer tax credits for those very same things. So we have an incentive program to help us get into that stuff. And, again, the cost of fuel is the single largest incentive. When those things become are cost effective, the smart operator will definitely install them.
Yes, President, follow up.
Thank you. Yes, I would like to follow up just a bit. So let's say around $15,000 per truck to take care of that sort of stuff. I think I recalled about $26,000 for the for an auxiliary. I'm recalling the wrong amount of money for
eight to ten thousand
for the other kind of generator to produce energy while the truck is off, but you need something to run the air conditioning,
right,
for example.
Right.
So thinking about the cost of this, if the idea is to phase it in over time, how often does a truck need certain kinds of repairs or upgrades just because the truck is aging? Some sort of things you wouldn't be upgrading at all, but tires, I assume a truck's going to need a new tire every once in a while.
Sure.
Could the rules be written in such a way so that as it's time to make a change, such as new tires, you're buying the different kind rather than the typical kind?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, certainly. But one of the points that I hoped that I made was that the trucking industry isn't monolithic. With my over-the-road fleets, for example, that are traveling long distances on the freeway, they're turning their trucks over every 3 years. But those trucks are then sold to someone else that is in a different service, and then they're sold to someone else, and eventually they end up on a farm, and after the farmer gets tired of them, they send them down to Mexico or to the Soviet Union. So it's difficult to come up with a rule of thumb. And if you were doing that, at least in my view, what you would do is you would say, well, the only tires that are available for sale are low-rolling resistance tires. I'm not sure that we are at a point that that makes sense, because if you're operating a short haul, for example, you've got a truck that's operating pickup and delivery service in Portland. They're never getting to the speeds where any of the aerodynamics do anything, and the low rolling resistance tires really don't benefit them either. So that it becomes very difficult to do a general rule, like if you were to say this is all that's available in the marketplace is low rolling resistance tires, you're forcing people to buy them that they don't benefit from them. Nobody benefits from them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Yes, Chair Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. First, Mr. Russell, I think I may not have followed very well when you were talking about the interaction between your proposed amendment and the MPO provisions from before.
Correct.
Could you go over that again?
Sure. Mr. Chair, the MPO provisions that we did in House Bill 2001, and then there was a separate bill that passed in 2009, and then there was a third one that passed in 2010. Those, with the exception of the statewide strategy that was an overlay in the 2010 bill, all of those provisions were dealing with vehicles 10,000 pounds and less. And you may recall that the idea was to reduce vehicle miles of travel of that population of vehicles. So it didn't apply in any way to heavy trucks. This proposal applies to vehicles 10,000 pounds and greater. So it does not apply to that population, nor could what we're trying to do be accomplished under the MPO provisions that were in 2001.
Thank you. I have an additional question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also want to ask you the same question or give you a chance to answer the same question that I asked the director. How would you characterize the discussions going forward, and might our successors hear you or someone else come with some opportunities to work on the pieces that don't appear to have generated consensus at this point?
Mr. Chair, you know, I never want to say never, because I can certainly see a path where we might talk about the truck efficiency stuff. It just gets so complicated because of the diversity within the industry itself, and one would think that these are business folks and the economic imperative of saving substantial amounts of money would be the driving force, and fuel prices already being close to $4, which is darn close to an all-time high. And I'm hearing from my members projections for next year for 60, a little better than that. As those fuel prices go up, you don't need a regulation. So recognizing those things, I can't say that we would, but certainly we always want to save fuel for a whole host of reasons, not the least of which is reducing emissions. So whatever we can do in that regard, we will certainly be at the table.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
What percentage of the relevant time would you say falls outside the 50 to, under 50 to 75 plus span? How much of the time we're talking about? Is that pretty darn rarely? Is it all the time during the winter and August? What are we talking?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I'm not a climatologist, so I really can't answer that question. I mean, having lived here for a long time, we are in a fairly moderate climate, and a lot of the temperatures are going to be between the 50 and 75 degree range, in my view. But I think equally as important, I think the general public has this conception of the trucking industry as being nothing but long-haul trucks and these guys living in their trucks. That's not the case.
Yeah, that's not my impression.
Yeah. We have lots of folks that are home every night and sleep in their beds. We have lots of folks, quite frankly, that their company puts them up in a motel. So it's a portion, a segment of the industry. It also happens to be the segment that is operating in interstate commerce, which, for those of you that are trained in the legal profession, understand that regulation of folks in interstate commerce is a little bit different kettle of fish, which we haven't raised here. But that's something we need to be thinking about. So you have that, and then you have, if you were living in a tin can, which basically that's what a truck is, what temperature would you feel comfortable in? And I think that that's the real question. What's humane here? And I see some states have said 32 degrees. I don't agree with that. I would not ask anybody to sleep in 32 degrees as a regular course of their life if that was their home. So I hope that's responsive to your question.
Mildly. which I appreciate. I agree on the humane part. I also agree on the 32 degrees part. I also think, you know, to the extent we have data, it'd be great, right? I mean, I'm just, like, I know it's only a segment of a segment. Right. I just have no idea how big that segment of a segment is. And I only know from personal experience what's comfortable to sleep and what's not,
right?
And that I can get. And, you know, if it is 75, sort of, I could probably survive, you know, 40 to 80, 40 to 79, you know, not 20 to 100, right? But data would help, you know, any port in a storm, you know, would be helpful to know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I will see if I can't do some research and get you some average temperature variations for
be helpful.
Oregon.
Further questions? Representative Lindsay, did you? No. I just have one. It's not often we have groups come in and beg to have their lives made more difficult. I'm asking, what is it that, I think you said it a couple of times, I need to hear it again, that would prompt the industry, the two industries we've heard from this afternoon,
right,
ask us to impose these regulations?
Mr. Chair, you know, it's back to sort of the three-part solution for the problem. We've got the cost of fuel, we've got incentives, and we have those both in place. We think that a reasonable regulation would help us reduce fuel costs for the trucking industry. That helps reduce shipping costs, so that's good for the whole economy. We also think it will reduce emissions, and both of the greenhouse gas variety and the other variety, and we live here too and think that's a good thing as well. So part of our motivation is altruistic, and part of it is economic. And I think part of it is a recognition of our industry. There is a certain portion of our industry that needs a little more encouragement to do the right thing than other parts of our industry. And I think that we're recognizing that and suggesting that we go forward with that.
Mr. Chair, yeah, if I might, when it comes to the medium-duty side of things, unfortunately, most of the people who operate trucks in medium-duty don't think of themselves as trucking people. They've got a bread company, and they have to get their bread to the store. And therefore, most of those payrolls for those drivers are set up based on incentives for what they deliver, what they sell, how fast they do, how much they do, so on and so forth. Quite candidly, the truck oftentimes is just that necessary evil, and it's very difficult for a lot of our customers to, I guess, convince their drivers to shut off fuel because the drivers aren't paying for the fuel, and the drivers are getting incentives to make more deliveries or to do this or do that. So I think it's, from that standpoint, quite candidly, any good businessman who runs a business would probably want to have his truck shut off while it's being delivered. But when it comes down to how they set the pay structures up, many times that's not the same. And so I think this type of regulation basically just helps the owners get the drivers to do what they'd like them to do for the medium-duty side of things.
Yeah, that makes it much more clear. Thank you very much. Further questions? Thank you very much, panel. We have three other folks signed up, Chris Hagenbaumer, Craig Honeyman, and Catherine Thomason, MD. Who would like to go first? Start with you. Go ahead.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Chris Hager-Baumer. I'm with the Oregon Environmental Council. And this packet that came out along with my testimony doesn't really relate to this bill so much because it's not about trucks, but rather about idling at school. Just in case any of you have school kids or know of school kids, it's a really fun program to get the 7th graders, 8th graders involved in reducing idling at school, and it helps them with their math skills. So to move on to my testimony, I'm here today to say that we support the original bill and oppose the amendments in their current form. So, as Bob Russell mentioned, to reduce our dependence on oil, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, to reduce pollution, trucks are a really important part of that. And I really appreciate the attention that both he and Don Emerson have, that really agreeing that an idling restriction is important, and we would agree with that. But we just don't think that this is strong enough. So House Bill 2081 was developed by pulling together a task force of stakeholders. It represents a fair and economically feasible way to move forward. But the amendments completely strip out the aerodynamics piece. And I would say that the way that the bill is written, it actually gives plenty of time for those to be phased in, and it does allow for economic issues to be taken into consideration if you can't afford to put on those types of technologies. I would also say that it's not, you don't have to necessarily do the whole shebang. If you look at low rolling resistance tires, those could be a less expensive piece of the aerodynamics than the others. So the idling provisions, as mentioned, were based on EPA's national idling rule, largely, which the American Trucking Association agreed with. But these amendments that are put forward today, I think, have so many exemptions in them that I don't think that very much idling will be reduced. And we do understand this concern about the auxiliary power units. And let me just explain, the difference really between the original bill and this bill is that this bill will allow, I'm sorry, the amendments, is that this will allow the idling to occur forever. It doesn't really ever require the trucker to purchase the APU or really push the truck stops to install the anti-idling technology. So that's, we really want to see that happen because that will reduce that unnecessary idling at overnight truck stops. Another piece in this is the 30 minutes of idling. It says in the amendments that you can allow up to 30 minutes of idling to wait to load or unload, or load or unload, but it doesn't really give any parameters about that. And let me give an example that I don't think would ever happen, but just to show how it's a little too loose. You could sit there and idle for 30 minutes waiting to load or unload. Then you could load or unload. Then you could turn your engine off for 5 minutes. Then you could start it up again and do that all over again. So I really think that if this moves forward, that piece needs to be fixed. We're also opposed to preempting local governments from enacting stronger provisions because we don't think that this bill is strong enough and feel that there could be a local jurisdiction that would be interested in putting something forward stronger. So let me give an example. A local government might want to post signage near schools or require no idling near schools or hospitals during particular time periods, but this would not allow them to do that. And that would be important, obviously, for protecting human health. And I think, actually, the education piece is a really big component to this. And I was talking to Don about the fact that it's actually really hard to educate the entire industry. There are not easy channels to do that, but that's a piece that I would like to be looked at because I think if people actually understand the fuel savings, et cetera, with idling, that we would get less of it through better education. I think also, just back to the greenhouse gas emissions piece, we know that improving technology and reducing wasteful use of fuel is one of the easier ways to reduce our carbon footprint, and the less that we do in this area, the more that we're going to have to do in other, perhaps harder areas. So we really encourage you to improve either past the original bill, and I'll stop here and say that Bob Russell and I always have very congenial and pleasant conversations and like each other in many ways, and we laugh a lot. So when Bob said, "Oh, that original bill will never pass," I said to Bob, Well, of course not, because you guys oppose it. So it would pass if you supported it, and we're laughing and laughing. I'm not going to get Bob to agree with the original bill, but I think that there may be places that we could strengthen these amendments. Thanks.
Thank you. Greg.
Co-Chair Benz, members of the committee. My name is Craig Honeyman. I'm the legislative director for the League of Oregon Cities. We represent all 242 cities in the state of Oregon. I will summarize my already brief statement, which either has been or will be distributed to you. My comments are relative to the original bill, House Bill 2081, Section 11, Paragraph 2, and Section 19, Paragraph 1, or the entirety of Section 6 in the Dash 1 amendments. We allaud the overall intent of this legislation, but find fault only with the sections that I've just referred to, and that is on the basis of the preemptive nature of that language, which is an issue that the League opposes preemption, that is, as a matter of our policy. Currently, cities throughout Oregon, especially in the MPOs, are actively working to address the challenges posed by global warming. This includes the creation of toolkits, public outreach programs, even scenario planning in some cases, leading to the probable adoption of more strenuous land use and transportation planning measures. So anything that infringes upon the ability of a city to adopt a standard for the purposes of the toolkit, we have concerns with. Now, let me acknowledge, as Mr. Russell pointed out to you, that everything I've just described in terms of the legislative mandates that we're dealing with relate to automobiles and vehicle miles traveled. But let me suggest that greenhouse gas emissions are greenhouse gas emissions, and we would prefer not to have any tools denied us. So we respectfully request the deletion in the original bill of the aforementioned sections, Section 11, Sub 2, and 19, Sub 1, or in the Dash 1 amendments, Section 6. Now, I must admit to you that there is only one city that I have been made aware of in the state of Oregon that currently has an idling regulation on the books. City of Ashland has Ordinance Number 2828, which was adopted in May of 2002, prohibiting truck and bus idling on public streets or in public parking areas for more than 5 minutes, the same threshold that's being proposed both in the bill and the Dash 1 amendments. So this legislation would not apparently impact the Ashland ordinance. And I also candidly need to tell you that I'm not aware of any other cities in the state that either have such ordinances or aspire to have such an ordinance. And finally, I would say that if an idling restriction is going to be established by any jurisdiction, 5 minutes seems to be reasonable. We just the League just does not feel or does not see a compelling need for this this preemption. So, with that, I'll conclude my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Thomason.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Catherine Thomason. It's a pleasure to address co-chairs in the committee. I was fortunate in being able to participate in the task force that helped bring about this bill and enjoyed hearing from the trucking industry, from the insurance trucking industry, from the small trucking industry, and from other concerned individuals. I represented Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility on that task force and was concerned with the health issues. First and foremost, my work as a physician is going to get more involved as our summer temperatures are going to rise at a minimum of 8 degrees Fahrenheit in the summer if we do all of these things, and up to 15 degrees if we don't, as well as dealing with more asthma, more allergies, more actual pollen, more east side drought and reduction in our clean drinking water and irrigation water. So I'm thrilled that the trucking industry and the other people involved in the task force are very much in favor of putting forth this kind of legislation. And I encourage you to support it as well. There is no downside to the anti-idling ordinance other than the installment of idle control technology, which is cost effective as it eliminates that on average, you heard two different figures, but on average it's 0.8 gallons per hour per truck utilized to run the auxiliary equipment. The compliance time frame for implementation that's provided in the original bill gives time to put these APU units on the various types of trucks that are going to need them, such as a cement mixer or such as a refrigeration truck, to continue to use auxiliary electricity. Using the APUs or the idle air technology, plug-in technology, will reduce carbon emissions by 92%, even if the electricity is drawn from Boardman's coal-burning power plant. Okay, so the efficiency involved here is so great compared to running diesel fuel. Some of the concerns I have about the amendments, I'm actually in favor of a couple of the amendments. The idling, it was discussed in the task force that the armored trucks, the fire and emergency vehicles needed some dispensation for idling because they didn't necessarily, weren't able to, going to be able to meet these kinds of things. But the ones that I have difficulty with are the ones that are this temperature regulation piece. If they had an AP unit on board, you don't have to worry about what the temperature is. The electricity is going to run the air conditioning unit or the heating unit and keep the cab comfortable. Keeping the cab engine turned off improves the driver's sleep. It reduces their own inhalation of carbon monoxide, diesel particulates, and other emissions that are coming out of the truck tailpipe. So this actually helps the health of the driver as well as improving their rest if we turn the cab engine off and use APUs instead. So that's one major thing, is that you can get rid of those two sections of the amendments by saying that we have a phase in time for the type of truck that needs to do long-term hauling and is going to use their cab as their home and needs electricity for that 10-hour downtime. The other major concern I have with the amendment is the limitation of increasing the limitation on idling from 5 minutes to 30 minutes. Again, I think if you have the few exemptions for emergency vehicles and armored vehicles, these other units are going to be much better served by having an electric or battery-powered type of facility on board that will then handle the electricity needs without having to use the engine, both in town and the 10,000-pound vehicles, as well as the larger vehicles as well. If that is in place, if the 5-minute idling rule is in place, I am in agreement that having additional regulations from every municipality or every part of a town or whatever would then be exempt. And that exemption is actually in the original bill. But the exemption should not apply if we loosen this idling to 30 minutes that has no parameter, 30 minutes over what period of time, kind of thinking that's in the amendments. I think the trucking industry is very wise in supporting an idling restriction and improving the aerodynamics, because they know that we will then, instead, if this doesn't go through, push for more freight train and they'll lose business. Thank you.
Thank you. And questions for this panel? The Chair Reed, we're kind of getting short on time. So
very quickly. Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering from OEC, if I'm understanding you correctly, that it would be your preference, if the choice, recognizing that you would prefer to keep working on amendments and so on, but if the choice is between the amendments that are before us and the bill, let me rephrase, between the amendments that are before us and no action, you would prefer what?
Chair Bentz, Representative Reed, I will say I'm extremely worried about the legislature taking a step that is so tiny that it will make us think that we've actually done something to address the problem. And then I worry that in the future we wouldn't come back to this in enough time to actually make a difference. So at this moment in time, I have to say we would rather see it die.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And with that, I'm going to carry this bill over until Monday, and I'll close the public hearing on HB 2081 and open a public hearing on 2356. We have Bob Russell, Vicky, and Chris Rice.
No.
Why don't you tell us, before you start, we'll have Zach tell us about the bill.
No. House Bill 2356 creates a commercial driver development fund to help provide education related to the trucking industry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and we're going to try to get you back on track here real quick.
Thank you.
I'm going to be very brief, but first I want to introduce Chris Rice, who's the Director of Driver Services from Sherman Brothers Truck Line down in Eugene, Oregon, and Vicky Handy, who's the President of Workforce Dynamics and the Executive Director of the Trucking Solutions Consortium. They're actually going to do most of the talking on this particular bill. A couple of things that I'd like to point out to you. Number one, this is all about jobs, and these are good jobs. And we've been working for 5 years to develop a program to develop new truck drivers, and we're real excited about it. And we hope that when you hear the presentation, you will be too. We think this is very important for the state. Earlier, I talked to you about how much of the tonnage of freight the trucking industry moves in this state. In 2008, we had 94,247 people employed in the trucking industry in Oregon alone. That's one out of 15 working folks were, in fact, employed in the trucking industry. Of those, 33,470 were truck drivers, and these are big truck drivers, 26,000 pounds and over. And they made an average wage of $34,665 a year. So these are family wage jobs. What we'd like to do is put folks back to work in the trucking industry. The good news is the last couple of years, my members had their trucks parked along the fence because they didn't have any business. Now, as we go around the state and visit with them in the a new president of the Oregon Trucking Association, Deborah Dunn, is sitting right there. And she has just made a tour of the entire state. And every place that she's been, the companies are saying, I've now got trucks parked because I don't have drivers. So this is a way to develop truck drivers, put people back to work, and help Oregon's economy. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Vicky.
Thank you, Bob. What I'd like to do more than anything today is give you a little bit of an overview of the infrastructure that we have in place that can really support investment in new truck drivers. I also want to show some of our projections, and more than anything, I really want to encourage your support for funding for tuition for our new truck drivers. A little bit about our consortium. Our consortium was established in 2006, and our focus is to collaboratively work together to get new drivers in, it's around recruitment, and then to provide training and development. Today, we have over 100 companies participating in our consortium, and we have over 300 members. Our consortium is a combination of industry, education, and regional representatives from WorkSource Oregon. Our strategic focus has been business improvement to try to get these trucking companies getting back into a profitable standing, which I think we've done some really good work around that, training, recruitment, communications, and statewide efforts. We have both a statewide as well as a regional presence. And again, our focus is recruiting new drivers and developing drivers and other members throughout the trucking companies. Our goals, our focus has been to professionalize the trucking industry. One of the things that we've really strived for is to build an infrastructure that can support the growth of the industry through changing the culture within the industry. And what we've really tried to do is change how we hire, how we train, and how we manage people. With that, we have developed rigorous curriculum, standardized training and certifications, career paths, And as you can see, we also promote green technology and practices throughout all of our training and our best practice conferences. I want to echo some of Bob's words when he talked about the increase in freight in Oregon. We know that we are heading toward a driver shortage. All of the companies that I work with right now are saying we are hiring not one or two, we're hiring 15, 20 drivers, and we can't find them. We are heading to what I believe will be a crisis. As our economy continues to rebound, this is going to increase in the impact not only to the trucking industry but to all industries. In recent surveys, recruiting and training drivers is identified to be one of the key obstacles in economic growth in trucking companies. Remember, trucking serves all industry clusters in our state. We like to say, and I borrowed this from OTA, if you got it, a truck brought it. If you help the trucking industry, you're really helping all of the sectors and clusters in our state. I don't want to be redundant with Bob's information, but I do want to say trucking average wage, $20 an hour. It is a high wage, high demand job. And one of the things that we do is track closely those people getting CDLs, commercial driver's licenses, and our professional truck driver certificate. We've trained about 859 people, and we have tracked and seen placement of 90% of those who have been trained and retained their positions. We can place all of the people going through truck driver training school, but that's the barrier. That's the barrier to employment. That's where we need your help. We have one other major impact that is significant for us. More than other industries, and we get this from workforce analysts with the state of Oregon, trucking has an aging workforce that is much higher than most other industries. We have only 3% of our workforce under 25. We have to bring in more players into our labor pool. Over 50% of our employees are over 45, with a quarter of them being over 55. With that, I'd like to introduce Chris Rice. He's been a member of our consortium, and he works for Sherman Brothers Trucking. I want him to share his perspective with his company, how this is impacting.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Rice. I'm the Director for Driver Services for Sherman Brothers Trucking. And I've been doing that for the last 6 years, and a member of the consortium for the last 4 years. I participated in training such as best practices, professionalizing the professional truck driver certificate, as well as we send other people in my company to other training such as train the trainer, so then we can try and professionalize our drivers as well. Our major role right now is we have 15 trucks sitting on our fence, and the fact is we cannot find quality individuals to put those trucks to work. Excuse me, I get a little nervous when I talk in public. So the main challenge right now is just finding quality individuals, certified individuals, people that can afford to go to truck school and afford that $4,000 to $5,000 that it's going to take to get them that CDL and, you know, put them back to work. Currently, right now, with the 15 trucks sitting, we have about 23 positions that we could put somebody to work today. So that's 23 individuals that we could put to work. So our I'm also a poor penmanship, so.
Actually, your penmanship is excellent compared to Mr. Russell.
You haven't seen it yet. So, the reason I'm here is to echo the fact that we can put people to work, and we need to put people to work. As freight increases, as the economy gets better, we're not only going to see companies fighting over, you know, the experienced truck drivers, you know, so therefore our truck count that, you know, from 15 is going to grow to 20, and we still have the same challenge. How are we going to get qualified individuals behind those seats? And the only way we can do that is by hiring, putting new truck drivers through school, get them certified, get them licensed, and put new people into our industry.
Okay.
We have a question.
Oh.
Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. By the way, it looks like your truck's idling. You might want to turn it off there.
I'll try to keep it to 5 minutes.
So my question is this is, yeah, we know a lot of people are looking for jobs. We had a good debate about it on the floor of the House today. Lots of people looking for jobs. And I'm a huge fan of perpetual education funds. Have them get a loan, have them pay it back at a low interest, and it just perpetuates itself. I think that's a great idea. But in the meantime, while we're working towards something like that, why don't the truck companies just pay these unemployed to go and get their CDL? And maybe put a requirement that they, if they leave in X amount of days or something, they have to pay that back.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lindsay, that's a great question. We've been at this for about 5 years. 4 years ago, we got $200,000 in a grant. And the purpose of the grant was to test the model here to see what worked. And we had $100,000 in grant money and $100,000 in loan money that we used to see how we could best get people into truck driving school and get them to work. And what we discovered was that the loan approach, the revolving loan fund, was the best because people had some skin in the game, quite frankly, and they were willing to put up the money to go to school to get a better job. So that was real positive. And what we also found is that once they graduated from school and got hired by the trucking company, in many, many cases, it was the trucking company that was repaying the loan, not the driver. The problem that we had is the trucking company won't give somebody the money to go to school. They'll reimburse them after they get their CDL and they've got proof that they can get behind the wheel. Mm-hmm. It's a sort of a chicken and the egg problem. With what we're asking for here, then we will be able to provide the low-cost loans, and then in most cases it will be the trucking company that will reimburse the loan fund for the next folks.
Follow up. And I fully understand that. But I would think that, I mean, obviously there's a lot of, in the legal profession, a lot of people, law firms will pay a student to take the bar exam or reimburse or pay the loan up front, and they may or may not pass the bar exam, we'll see. And they do it that way. Police officers, they get hired and then they're paid to go through the academy. I'm just wondering why the trucking companies don't do that with some sort of hook. I can understand they don't want to pay a bunch of people to go through and don't get it, but give them a little bit of a hook to get through. Is it just that it doesn't pencil out on paper? I'm assuming that if you had all these 15 trucks that are lined up, if they're filled and they're running, they're making revenues,
sure,
that would outpace the cost of this. So just not pencil out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lindsay, again, you've got such a diverse industry, so I can't give you a rule of thumb for the whole thing. All I can tell you is that in our experience, rather than advance somebody the $4,000 to go to truck school, the trucking company is going to try to steal their competitors' drivers. And that's what we found, and we also concluded that that's not going to solve our industry's problem. And as our industry's association, we needed to create a system that actually produces new truck drivers instead of following the old paradigm of stealing truck drivers from one another. So I guess the short answer to your question is we were not able to find trucking companies that would advance the tuition to someone in order to get their CDL. They were willing to hire them once they had their credential, but they were not willing to advance the money up front to help them get that credential.
Colleagues, we have about 3 minutes left. Just before we take more questions, did you have more that you wanted to say?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do, because I want you to understand.
Again, you have to compress it into like a minute. If you can
okay.
do that, please do so.
I can do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And then we'll come back to Representative Mason, like really fast.
What I want to do is simply make sure you understand the infrastructure that we've built to support this process. We have developed our professional truck driver certificate. It's a statewide certificate. It is upgraded the truck driver training. we know we can't just poach other drivers. We have to bring new drivers in. Truck driving companies are oftentimes willing to repay a loan, but not say, hey, you, we'll hire you if you go do this. It's like, oh, you've done it, we'll hire you, we'll repay the loan. But we still have to get them into the stream. We have developed the infrastructure across our entire state. We have worked with all of the training truck driver training schools in this process, and we have consensus with the community colleges and the truck driving schools to deliver this system and program. We have already taken care of any adverse impact issues. We have public-private partnerships that move us forward in a collaborative model. In fact, right now we're also getting them certified to administer the National Career Readiness Certificate. Again, statewide effort. I want to mention our pilot program. We had a pilot program in Clackamas County in 2007. Bob referred to it. We said we could certify 50 drivers. We ended up to date with 93 drivers who are still employed today. This has been an incredibly powerful and successful program. We want to roll it out statewide and make this available to all of our regions, especially some of our hardest hit regions like in Southern Oregon. We're ready for statewide implementation. Everything's in place. And so we really want your support to get us over this barrier. We need qualified drivers with their commercial driver's license. And so I encourage you, the Trucking Solutions Consortium encourages you to support the tuition funds for training in the Professional Truck Driver Certificate and CDL and continuing our consortium work, moving this forward with a quality model.
Thank you so much for pressing that. Representative Nathanson.
Mr. Chair, I know that we won't have time for my questions now. I'd like to just alert you and the committee to what I would have been asking about. It has to do with the impact on community colleges, their ability to manage this. Will we be hearing requests from community colleges on the other side, you know, for some extra assistance? And a couple other questions. I'll ask them at a subsequent day.
Right. In fact, we plan on carrying this over until Monday, so that'll maybe just give us that opportunity.
Might I address that, Mr. Chair?
Well, and actually, we're going to have to carry it over because in about a minute, someone's going to come through that door. Mr. Russell, I have one thing to say.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, when we first proposed this, given the financial climate for the state, we weren't very enthusiastic about the results. However, I did want to let you know that we have offered an alternative. We have had a tax credit that's been in place since 1993, and it costs the state now about $250,000 a year or $5,100 a biennium. House Bill 3170 is going to be amended in Energy and Environment and Natural Resources that would sunset that tax credit effective June 30th, saving the state the money that this request would cost. So with that, we would ask for your support, and we will see you on Monday.
Monday.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to carry over House Bill 2356 till Monday, close the public hearing on 2356,
right,
and adjourn the House Committee on...